From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Curling up with a good book is one of life's great pleasures, sometimes a simple pleasure, sometimes not. This year's crop of new books took us from Hillary Clinton's heartache memoir to the moral ambiguity of a black slave owner in the antebellum South. We love to hear what other people love to read. Booksellers, book critics, and you. Up next on Point, the plot thickens, the best books of 2003. But first, President Bush today named former Secretary of State James Baker as his personal envoy to convince the world to forgive or restructure the $100 billion pile of debt that Iraq built up under Saddam Hussein. Mara Reynolds covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times and joins me now from Washington. Mara, what's behind this new appointment?
Well, on the surface of it, I think the main thing is that the debt is a huge problem, and that any way you look at it, the size of Iraq's debt is going to cripple their economy in the next few years if people insist on being paid on time. But beyond that, I think that there's another issue, which is a recognition that relationships with allies have been frayed by the Iraq experience, and someone with the stature and the credibility of James Baker might do a lot to repair them.
The announcement from the White House today and word from the White House indicated that Baker will travel extensively all over the place working on debt. But as you say, it's also a channel maybe open. This is an old Bush family friend, very high in George W. Bush's father's administration and, of course, in George Bush's 2000 election campaign resolution in Florida. Could this be, in effect, a kind of shadow Secretary of State?
Oh, I think that would be going too far. This White House has been, despite all of the talk about the vice president or the secretary of state or other people actually really running the show, George Bush does keep a very tight control on the reins and does tug them when he wants to. But I think that you are right in saying that Baker will have a degree of credibility and influence with allies that perhaps no one, including the president, might have at the present moment. And in that sense, he could be an invaluable ally to the president.
Jim Baker went out before the first Gulf War and put together an enormous coalition, very, very much unlike what went into this war with Iraq. Do you think he'll be going out to woo old allies, or does he go out as the leg breaker? I mean, it's pretty tough to make people give up billions of dollars in money owed to them.
Well, there's probably going to be a bit of both. I mean, he's a very accomplished diplomat, and so I think he knows how to use carrots and sticks equally well. I think that many of the regimes in the Middle East are still the same, or at least the people who are leading them are people that he had contact with as Secretary of State. He's got relationships that, you know, that go back many years and decades. And so I think that you know, a little cajoling and a little pressure, I think he's probably better than many people that you could think of to provide just the right incentives.
And more, do you know the finance stakes here? If Iraq just doesn't pay back what it's owed on schedule, does it risk going into default? And given everything that's happened there, is that a problem or not? It's kind of America's baby now. Can they just assume that Washington will bail them out if they lose credibility in the rest of the world?
Well, this all does go back to the Persian Gulf. The UN right now is still collecting reparations from Iraq through oil income for Gulf War reparations that it has approved and is paying out. So it's not as simple as just if Iraq decides it can't pay. I mean, the United Nations has the right to control much of Iraq's oil income right now, and that is income that the administration very much wants to go first into rebuilding.
Oh, you're saying
debt repayment.
This isn't just ordinary international debt. This is also money that Iraq is supposed to pay sort of punitively for the damage it did in the invasion of Kuwait.
There's a number of different pieces here, and the numbers are truly staggering. There's about $120 billion in sovereign country-to-country debt. But in addition to that, there's as much as $200 million in Iraq war reparations from the first Persian Gulf War. And like I said, that's money that was authorized to be paid by the United Nations and would require an act of the Security Council. And I'm not exactly sure of all the bureaucratic ins and outs, but it would be quite a large issue for the international community if those reparations were not paid.
And finally, Maura, what's the scuttlebutt about how Jim Baker's reemergence might affect White House policy now? I mean, the word was a year ago that the old cohort of George Bush's father was not so crazy about the new American unilateralism. Has he been around and advising? Is this new to bring him in? Might he shift the focus of the administration?
Well, I think there's some different views on that at the moment. I mean, certainly the current president's inner circle has been largely drawn by from more ideological conservatives as opposed to sort of more Baker-style traditional Republican mm-hmm. diplomats. But if you look at policies outside of the Middle East, there are some people who argue that Bush has always had a multilateralist strain, that he's got both things going in his foreign policy, and that this is just sort of a more of an adjustment than an about-face. I think views are very different on that.
Well, it'll be a bit of deja vu to see Jim Baker back on the world stage. Maura Reynolds, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. Toni Morrison found more love. William Boyd took readers on an unforgettable journey with Any Human Heart. This hour, On Point, we're talking about the best books of the year, blockbusters, surprise gems, and those that are just plain fun to read. We're turning the pages with some of the sharpest minds in the book world and asking them to share their lists of the year's best. We want to hear from you, too. What's been your favorite book this year? What kept you up reading late into the night? Which books are you wrapping up as holiday gifts to the mind? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me quickly introduce our panel tonight. Joining us from New York is Charlotte Abbott, book news editor for Publishers Weekly. Good evening and welcome, Charlotte Abbott.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Also from New York, Lev Grossman, book editor for Time Magazine. Lev, welcome back.
Thanks.
It's good to have you. And with me in the studio tonight, Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Carol Horn, great to have you again.
I'm delighted.
Charlotte Abbott, start us out here with a kind of overview. Were there trends in the books that sold, in the books that got raves this year? How do you frame it up?
Well, in publishing, it's been the best of times, the worst of times, which is par for the course in this industry. More books are being published than ever, and book clubs have become a pop culture phenomenon in their own right. Excuse me. Not only does Oprah have a new book club that's been selling as many books as her old one, but many other network and cable TV book clubs are also putting books on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And then you have citywide reading groups and grassroots book clubs, which are still growing in popularity.
So a lot of things churning interest on the flip side?
The economy has definitely taken a toll on book sales this year. They were soft in the first two quarters. Things looked up a bit in June when Harry Potter and Hillary Clinton's memoir pulled people back into the stores, and those books became national news stories. And Oprah's new book club scored big.
But it's not new books.
Well, no, it's books that have stood the test of time.
Right.
And John Steinbeck's East of Eden sold as well or better than any other book she's chosen.
Which publishing houses have been particularly hot this year, Charlotte?
There are a couple. Doubleday had a string of bestsellers, starting with The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, which became a bit of a cultural phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Lauren Weisberger's The Devil Wears Prada was another long-running bestseller for the house, and that's the Boss from Hell story modeled on Vogue editor and editor-in-chief Anna Wintour. Mm-hmm. They also had Jon Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven and Chuck Palahniuk's Diary, a sort of quirky novel. And they had a few quirky literary breakouts. A novel called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night about an autistic child was a Today Show pick. That gave it some velocity. Mm-hmm. There's also, I mean, another house that's hot is Hyperion. That's the book arm of Disney. They have a big bestseller right now with Five People You Meet in Heaven by Mitch Albom.
His follow-on to Tuesdays with Maury, I guess.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So they're hot. Let's get to what people like. Lev Grossman, what's at the top of your list this year and why?
Well, you know, I don't think of myself as a curmudgeonly book critic, but I did find myself disagreeing a lot with the prevailing wisdom. So the book that I really latched onto this year as the wonderful book that I just can't stop thinking about is a book that almost nobody else read or reviewed. It's called Any Human Heart by William Boyd, who's a very well-established British novelist. This is a book that came out in February and went, as far as I can tell, nowhere sales-wise. It's written in the form of a diary by a man who lived through most of the 20th century and had a long and interesting and rather moving life.
A Britisher with a kind of a parentage split between, what was it, South America and a British mother or something?
That's exactly right. And he's sort of in between, you know, two worlds. He's somewhat aristocratic but not very wealthy. And he has this way, this Zelig-like way of meeting everybody from, you know, Picasso to the Duke of Windsor. And he really is an inconsequential man who never accomplishes very much, but he bounces around between people and just manages to be interesting for about 85 years.
It's kind of the story of the decline of the British way of life, the British global suzerainty. Is that in A Human Heart?
I think that's part of the story. It's also a story about art. It's about a story about war and the cataclysmic conflicts that destroyed lives throughout the 20th century. And it's also a very personal human story about love and sex and heartbreak. I couldn't put it down, and nobody else, as far as I can tell, picked it up.
Is it on bestseller lists anywhere?
Not as far as I know. It's on the bestseller list in my heart.
Right. Well, that's a pretty good recommendation. Any Human Heart by William Boyd. Kellhorn, what's at the top of your list?
Well, I just wanted to follow up on Any Human Heart. It always breaks our human hearts at the bookstore when we love a book and we loved this one. And it just doesn't sell as well as you'd like it to. And we did everything we could to push this book.
So you put it out by the front door. You put a stack of them there and still.
We put it in our monthly promotions.
Well, why do you think that happens? A book that Lev loved, you loved, maybe Charlotte loved it too, I don't know. Why doesn't it move? What's the trick?
I just don't know. I mean, it got good reviews, as he always does. Maybe tonight, talking about it will be what it needs.
maybe there's the spark. What's your top pick?
Well, it was just an extraordinary fall, and I thought it was interesting that three of us didn't overlap to speak of. My very favorite probably was Love by Toni Morrison.
Hmm.
I think it's the best novel since Beloved. I thought it was just really extraordinary.
Tell us about it, because I have to admit, somewhere along the line, I kind of lost the thread of Toni Morrison. She just got away from me after loving some of the early novels. What's in Love?
Well, I think that happened to a lot of people, and this, to me, really harkens back almost to the feeling of Sula, one of her very earliest novels. It's the story of a wealthy black resort owner and the six or seven women in his life, from lovers, employees, daughters, granddaughters, who are just obsessed by him. And it's really the story of the women and how he plays such a central role in their lives.
And Toni Morrison playing those themes of love and hate. And he's kind of a checkered character himself in the end.
He is. You get very different views of him from, you know, almost a saint to a really pretty despicable character.
And Charlotte Abbott, what's at the tip top of your list?
I really enjoyed Sherman Alexie's 10 Little Indians. He's, I think, best at writing short stories, and in this book, I found, and I think a lot of other reviewers found, that he is really at the height of his power.
Sherman Alexie is a Native American writer, is that right, from Washington State, or have I got that right?
That's exactly right. He's a Spokane Indian, and he brings a sense of playfulness, I think, a real sort of Indian humor. I actually grew up in a part of California that was very close to an Indian reservation and went to school with some Indian kids, and there's a quality that he really captures. But it's beyond that, it's accessible, I think, to a wide audience. I mean, because love is really his theme, romantic love, the love between members of a family. And he's also, of course, exploring what it means to be Native American today.
So it's right up front there. We're going to hear a lot more from all of our guests tonight, Charlotte Abbott, Lev Grossman, and Carol Horn. We want to hear from you as well. We're talking about great books, 2003, big hits, sleepers, favorite reads, the best you've read. Let us know, what was the book that kept you up reading this year? What was your favorite book, 2003? What book made you think, made you feel? And what were the duds on your list? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about great books, 2003, big hits, sleepers, favorite reads, the best you've read. We're joined tonight by Charlotte Abbott. She's book news editor for Publishers Weekly. Lev Grossman is also with us from New York. He's book editor at Time Magazine. And with me in the studio tonight, Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can join the conversation as well. What were you looking for in a book this year? Did you find it? Were you reading William Boyd, Toni Morrison, Sherman Alexie, Jhumpa Lahiri? Did you crack Da Vinci's code? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Carol Horn, let us get just a little bit of a seance going here. Bring Toni Morrison into the room so it's not all just titles. Could you read just a little bit of that Toni Morrison's Love for us?
Sure. Who would have thought that in the teeth of the Depression, colored people would want to play? Or if they did, how could they pay for it? Mr. Cozy, that's who. Because he knew what a harmonica player on a street corner knew. Where there was music, there was money. Check the churches if you doubt it. And he believed something else. If colored musicians were treated well, paid well, and coddled, they would tell each other about such a place where they could walk in the front door, not the service entrance, eat in the dining room, not the kitchen, sleep with the guests, sleep in beds, not their automobiles, buses, or in a whorehouse across town. A place where their instruments were safe, their drinks unwatered, their talent honored, so they didn't have to go to Copenhagen or Paris for praise. Flocks of colored people would pay to be in that atmosphere. Those who had the money would pay it. Those who didn't would find it. It comforts everybody to think of all Negroes as dirt poor and to regard those who were not, who earned good money and kept it, as some kind of shameful miracle. White people like that idea because Negroes with money and sense made them nervous. Colored people liked it because in those days they trusted poverty, believed it was a virtue and a sure sign of honesty. Too much money had a whiff of evil and somebody else's blood. Mr. Cozy didn't care. He wanted a playground for folk who felt the way he did, who studied ways to contradict history.
Carol Horn reading from Toni Morrison's Love, and the counterintuitive thing there, Toni Morrison writes, was colored people with money. There was another counterintuitive book, and I want to hear if any of you read it, what you thought of it this year. Edward Jones's The Known World, a kind of Faulkner-esque rendering of black slave owners' antebellum. Lev Grossman, did you read it?
Well, a book critic doesn't like to admit that he didn't finish a book.
Nevertheless.
But I'll tell you, I read about half of it, and I would say that it's very brilliant and very challenging. And I, past that, I'm probably not qualified to pronounce.
You know, I have to admit, I read about the same portion of it, and I felt like Edward Jones, it seems to just spin naturally out of him, but I wasn't sure where it was going. Charlotte, did you read that, The Known World?
I have to admit that I'm in Lev's camp. I was really quite enchanted by his use of language, and the density of the prose really pulls you into that time. You have to concentrate. The work is very atmospheric, but I can't call it a page-turner.
Edward Jones was with us and read a little bit of it for us. Let's hear that. Here's Edward Jones in his own voice reading from his novel, The Known World. Slaves.
A few women had cried, remembering the way Henry smiled, or how he would join them in singing, or thinking that the death of anyone, good or bad, master or not, cut down one more tree in the life forest that shielded them from their own death. But most said or did nothing. Their world had changed, but they could not yet understand how. A black man had owned them, a strange thing for many in that world, and now that he was dead, maybe a white man would buy them, which was not as strange. No matter what, though, the sun would come up on them tomorrow, followed by the moon, and dogs would chase their own tails, and the sky would remain just out of reach.
Edward Jones reading from his novel, The Known World, their slaves reacting to the death of their black slave owner, Henry Townsend. We have so many callers who are going to want to join us soon. I can see we're not going to get to this one by one. Let's play a little game here. Lev, would you give us, just read down the rest of your, I don't know, top five fiction favorites this year so we can get them into the mix and we'll come back and talk about them. What else have you got there beyond William Boyd and Any Human Heart?
Well, very quickly, I'd throw out Jonathan Lethem's Fortress of Solitude. Jhumpa Lahiri, The Namesake, was a very strong book. Nicholson Baker, A Box of Matches, was, I thought, fantastic. And I think the last one I'd pick would be Neal Stephenson, Quicksilver.
Quicksilver, this is sort of the novelistic rendering of a competition between what, Leibniz and Newton or scientists battling over who was the greater, if I got that right?
That's right, although it's so much more entertaining than that sounds.
Well, pardon me. Because how does he work it up, Quicksilver?
It's this sort of astonishingly funny, witty, fast-moving sort of intellectual thriller in a way. It's what I think I'd hoped that the Da Vinci Code would have been, but really wasn't. Stevenson is just a brilliant, funny, humane writer who explains incredibly complicated ideas in a way that makes you feel as if you've mastered them, and it makes you excited about them as well. I just can't say enough about that book.
Charlotte Abbott, let me turn to you on the front of the Da Vinci Code. This is Dan Brown's book, a huge bestseller. It's just stayed right at the top of the list for a long, long time, but I'm not sure it's on any of your lists tonight. Is it on yours, Charlotte? Oh, good. It's missing from the two others. What do you make of it? Why do people love it so much? Why do you think your colleagues here might not?
Well, I should start out by saying that I don't read a lot of thrillers, and I think one of the keys to this book's success is that it appeals to people who don't.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly a plot that has a lot of cliffhangers. It's written in a very sort of old-fashioned style, where at the end of every chapter, you know, you're in a breathless chase, or you're turning the corner, and you know, who knows what you're facing next.
And give us just a little sense of that plot for the two or three listeners who haven't read it.
How to put it into a nutshell. There is a Harvard symbologist, someone who studies art and spiritual symbols,
mm-hmm.
who is drawn into a murder investigation when the curator at the Louvre, who he was meant to meet on a particular night, mm-hmm. Is found dead in a very sort of lurid pose that's related to Da Vinci's paintings. And it turns out that he was part of a sect that included Leonardo da Vinci and a number of other sort of high-profile figures through the ages who sort of kept secrets that the Catholic Church had strived hard to hide over many years.
Secrets and reaching all the way back to the days of Jesus of Nazareth.
Up to Jesus and well, I don't want to go any further without spoiling the plot, mm-hmm. but the Holy Grail is involved in a major way.
So there's this big kind of cultural safari that goes along with the thriller plot.
Right.
Is that right?
Because certain clues are hidden in the paintings of Leonardo da Vinci. And so this Harvard expert and cryptologist who was the niece of the dead man he was the last remaining member of this group, so they try to find the keys to the secret that the group held, and it turns out that there are a lot of powerful enemies that are trying to stop them.
Carol Horn, it's not on your list. Why didn't Da Vinci Code make your top?
Well, I read it. I thought it was lots of fun. I have to say I didn't quite understand what the to-do was about, and it is still one of the bestsellers in the store. There were so many good books. The other things on my list.
Yes, please.
The Known World, I did finish and I did love, mm-hmm. and that's the second one on my list.
Maybe finishing it is the key.
Fortress of Solitude, which Lev mentioned.
Yes.
Old School by Tobias Wolff, which I just finished and I think is really one of the most lovely little books this fall.
This is set at a New England prep school.
Set at a prep school.
1960s.
A young man trying to fit into the school. There's a competition for a writing competition judged by, somehow they get people like William Faulkner and Ayn Rand, and I don't want to go too far into it, but Ernest Hemingway figures into it.
We're bringing a lot of history back to life in these books, it looks
yeah.
like. That's Tobias Wolff's Old School.
And my last one is The Dogs of Riga by Henning Mankell. This is my current passion.
The Dogs of Riga.
It's the second in a series of Swedish police procedurals, and they're just great fun.
Swedish police procedurals. It sounds like Smilla's Sense of Snow Redux or something. Has it got the same tone?
A bit. I mean, the earlier Swedish folks that he's compared to, if I can pronounce their names, were Sjöwall and Wallu, who wrote wonderful Swedish detective stories probably 20 years ago. This is a
A body washes up on the Riga, the Baltic coast somewhere, and these two Swedish policemen have to track down what's happened.
Yep, he winds up going to Latvia.
And in the process, they see all that's kind of come unraveled in post-Soviet Eastern Europe, in this case, Baltics.
Yes.
Well, there's a plot. Charlotte, we've got from your top fiction list, 10 Little Indians, Sherman Alexie, and The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown. You've got one more there. Tell us about that.
That was The Book of Salt by Monique Truong, which is a quieter novel, but one that for me had lingering charms. It is set in Paris in the 30s and 20s and 30s, and it's in the milieu of, in the home, actually, of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. But it's told from the point of view of their Vietnamese cook, who is kind of an invisible figure in Paris at that time. He's a gay man. He's Vietnamese. He, scours the food markets early in the morning and kind of lives this shadowy existence. And yet he has a very well-defined kind of and yet mysterious perspective on the lives of Stein and Picasso and all the people who parade through their house.
So the Vietnamese cook in Paris looking on at these artists. And the author is Monique Truong. Is she Vietnamese-American?
Yes, she is.
So you've got this kind of meeting of cultures and seeing it all through the eyes of the Vietnamese narrator or protagonist?
That's right.
Oh, really,
and it's just the language is wonderful. It's sort of, he's a man of many veils. He's not really understood by most people who see him, just see straight through him. He's not someone whose story was part of the dominant narrative of the time. And that story unfolds his life in Vietnam, how he came to Paris, how he came to their household, and where he ends up after working for them, his love affairs. But all of this is commingled with this, rich, fertile milieu of the salon that Gertrude Stein ran.
Sounds really fascinating. I've got to catch up with Monique Truong. We're going to turn to callers in just a moment. We have a lot of them waiting to come on. But I wondered, Lev, if you could read just a little bit from William Boyd's Any Human Heart. Do you have a passage there that might give us a flavor of your favorite?
Yeah, I do. I'll read something very short, and I'll quickly set it up by saying our protagonist is in his mid-40s. We're about midway through the book, and he suffered some terrible reversals, and he feels he's being persecuted by the Duke of Windsor. And he was imprisoned, and he suffered these terrible losses. And now he's received a piece of news which suggests that everything that he thought he knew about the Duke was completely wrong. So I'll just read this quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Colonel Marion died in April 1945 in a motor vehicle accident in Brussels. According to Vanderpool, there were two other fatalities. He had asked his old NID contacts, but as far as he could establish, there was nothing suspicious in Marion's death, and he had no apparent connections to the Duke of Windsor. So much for my great vendetta. So much for the tireless hunt for my betrayer. Isn't this how life turns out more often than not? It refuses to conform to your needs. The narrative needs that you feel are essential to give rough shape to your time on this earth. I wanted to hunt down Marion. I wanted to confront him, but instead am left with the banal conclusion that more than likely there was no conspiracy and that the Duke and Duchess had not plotted with their powerful friends to have done with me. Hard to live with this. Hard to come to terms with the fact that it was just another botched operation, another baffling run of bad luck, feelings of depression, feelings of frustration, feelings of emptiness in the face of all this randomness. Done down by the haphazard yet again. It's this fantastic moment when he realizes that the sort of the model of for the previous sort of quarter of his life that he'd been living was completely wrong, and he had no idea what was happening to him. And this phrase, sort of rough shape, characterizes so much of what this book is about. I'm just sort of struck anew by how brilliant it is every time I look at it.
Lev Grossman reading from Any Human Heart by William Boyd, and the great vendetta is over. The plug is pulled on it, I guess, on a life's narrative there. We're talking about great books, 2003. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Michael's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Michael.
Yes, hi.
I want to talk about a book I've read. I got it on Amazon.com.
Okay.
And it's called A Match Made in Hell.
A Match Made in Hell. And who's the author, Michael?
Larry Stillman.
Okay. What's the story?
Well, it's about a young man as the Nazis are coming in Poland. And his father and the neighbors are friends, but it turned out the neighbors like rat on them, and the father gets taken away, and the boy runs to the forest.
Are they Jews? Are they gypsies? Why are they picked up by the Nazis?
Well, it's World War II, and I guess the Nazis are going through Poland and rounding people up.
Okay.
And not being very nice to them. Mm-hmm. It was a Jewish family.
Okay, got it.
And so the boy makes it to the forest, and the only way he stays alive is he finds a man in the forest who turns out really is just a common criminal and kind of a mercenary. And they sort of form a bond that keep them both alive through the next few years.
Got it. And so what was it exactly about the story, Michael, that caught you? What did you like so much about it?
Sort of how this boy ends up doing things like, shooting people and rigging up bombs and that sort of thing, not because he wanted to, not mm-hmm. because he thought it was a just cause, but just because that's what he did, that this man was nice to him and it kept him alive.
It sounds almost like a Washington sniper story, except they're fighting Nazis. Fascinating. Michael, thanks for your call. I wonder, Charlotte, Lev, Carol, anybody know the book? A Match Made in Hell?
I don't, actually. It sounds like it has some of the flavor of maybe of A Painted Bird, the Jerzy Kaczynski. It sounds intriguing.
Michael, thanks for your call. Mary's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a couple of books, but I have some for young kids.
Okay.
They were, one was Jane Yolen. She wrote Girl in a Cage about the daughter of Robert the Bruce, who was caged for a long period of time by Edward Longshanks, like in a public square.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one.
A Braveheart fame, right?
Yes, very, very good. And it talks about Braveheart. And Anything by Louise Renison, the Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging series, which is...
Full Frontal Snogging, did you say?
Oh, my God. My kids are reading them off the shelf.
It sounds like a distant cousin of, not so distant, of Lemony Snicket.
Well, no, it's actually a distant cousin of the Bridget Jones Diary kind of thing.
Okay.
And it's The Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I highly recommend them for anybody who's buying for a young adult. But two of my more adult books are Amy, which was written by Mary Beth Miller, about a girl who commits suicide, but it's the story of the people who are left after her suicide and the kids, a group of kids who are blamed for her suicide. Is mm-hmm. it murder? Is it suicide? Excellent. And lastly, my most favorite book to date, which is Paradise Alley by Kevin Baker, a story of the Civil War riots in New York, and the book is 600 pages long and takes place over the 5 days of the Civil War riots, and it's the story of the Irish and the blacks who came to New York City and had to eke out a living, and it is just heart-wrenchingly beautiful, and I heard it on the TV, and I picked it up at the library and read it in 3 days.
Heart-wrenchingly beautiful. The praise doesn't get much better than that. Mary, thank you very much for your call. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about Great Books 2003. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Were you swept up in Krakatoa, the known world, positively Fifth Street? What made your list for Great Books this year? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Great Books 2003, about big hits, sleepers, favorite reads, the best you've read. My guest tonight, Charlotte Abbott, book news editor for Publishers Weekly. Lev Grossman, book editor for Time Magazine. Both of them joining us from New York. And with me in the studio tonight, Carol Horn, head book buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can join the conversation, too. What was the best book you read this year? What kept you reading? What's sticking with you at year's end? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charlotte, Lev, Carol, we haven't even touched on your nonfiction picks this year. Let's get them out on the table real quickly here because we've got a lot of calls. But Charlotte, what's at the top of your nonfiction list?
Well, I really enjoyed David Quammen's Monster of God.
We had him on. Quite a story about great beasts in nature as nature's changing around them.
That's right. And also in human history and art and religion.
Sort of lions, tigers, bears, crocodiles, all that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
that
was wonderful. I would read anything that he writes. Mm-hmm. He's such a great writer. And also Nicole LeBlanc's Random Family. The subtitle is Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. And that's it's a portrait of an extended family in the Bronx, and it's a plain-spoken and relentless portrait of how demanding poverty is.
You know, I haven't read that, but I heard her reading from it, and it was the intimacy of the detail was and the drama of it was absolutely overpowering in the reading I heard. Lev, what's on your nonfiction list?
Well, I would definitely make the case for Simon Winchester's Krakatoa, which came out this spring.
Now, explain that to me, because I haven't read it. I almost always love his stuff, but it surely can't be just about a volcanic eruption.
Well, I mean, the great thing about Winchester is he takes these, you know, these wonderful, you know, sort of natural events, catastrophic or otherwise, and he manages, just through relentless research and a real genuine storytelling talent, to dramatize them in terms of the human lives that they affect.
So an Indonesian volcanic eruption that sort of changed the climate of the world and maybe the climate of Indonesia.
That's right. But, you know, somehow he manages to get into the records and identify, you know, the sort of some journalist who was staying on a nearby island and what they were doing and how their wife felt about it and when the china fell off the table. Somehow he manages to come up with these details that make
great.
It absolutely gripping.
He's great. What else is there? Nonfiction.
I was a huge fan of David Moranis, They Marched Into Sunlight.
Yes.
An extraordinary book about a group of soldiers in Vietnam and a group of protesters at the University of Wisconsin.
I'm not ashamed to say it made me cry, that book. Quite a book.
It was powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I fell also for Augustine Burroughs' memoir, Dry, which was an account of his struggle with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
This is the writer who did Running with Scissors last year. It was a
great
hit.
Right. Great, some good ones. And Carol Horn, nonfiction, what's on your list?
Tracy Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains, his book about Dr. Paul Farmer.
Oh, Tracy and Paul Farmer were here talking with us. That's quite a story of his extraordinary health outreach, medical outreach around the world, particularly in Haiti.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And I think Tracy Kidder has finally found a topic worthy of his writing talents. Mm-hmm. I've always loved reading him, but this is really an important book, I think. Reading Lolita in Tehran was one of my favorites.
This is Azar Nafifi.
Nafisi.
Nafisi, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. She was a professor at the university, lost her job when everything changed for women in Iran, had a group of 8 women who came to our house for 2 years and read forbidden Western books, Fitzgerald, Lolita.
What a great premise, or I guess more than a premise, what a great thing to observe and write about.
Yeah, it was really a great book. Paul Krugman's collection, The Great Unraveling.
A smart, angry man.
There. A smart, angry man. And I think a man who has a lot of good things to say.
Big damning critique of the Bush administration and the media, I guess.
Yeah. Robert Hughes' new book on Goya, I think, is really, really wonderful. He, more than most art critics, puts himself into the story, and I find that really interesting.
Lots of character in the narrator's voice and place in the book.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the second volume of R.F. Foster's, you'd have to call it monumental. It's the second volume alone, I think, is about 600 or 700 pages. Autobiography of Yeats is really amazing.
The arch poet, he calls him.
Yeah, and he's a historian at Oxford, but he's become quite a good literary critic. His discussion of the poems is, I think,
it's the
really
literary
quite
criticism
good.
Within the memoir that most moved you in that book?
It all interested me. I mean, there's Irish history. The Yeats, not only as poet, but as politically involved, the whole political situation in Ireland at the time, his life and loves and his poetry.
R.F. Foster's W.B. Yeats, A Life to the Arch Poet. A lot of callers want to join us. Eugene's calling from Viola, Wisconsin. Hi, Eugene. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Great to have you.
The first book I've just gotten done with, and for the life of me, I can't remember the author, was The Main Enemy, The Final Showdown Between the CIA and the KGB in the Cold War.
Oh, I think that's Milt Bearden's book.
Yep,
we've had him on the show, and he's quite a talker. Is he quite a writer, too?
Oh, boy, I tell you what, it'll keep you on the edge of your seat, because he takes the chapters and he breaks the chapters up into times and days.
And Milt Bearden,
he jumps it back and forth between Langley and Moscow.
So you can see it's sort of in the wind down of the Cold War from the perspective of an ex-CIA guy, exactly how that exchange, that back and forth, was going on.
And he also includes the problems they had with Webster, because Webster had come from the FBI to CIA.
Mm-hmm. The CIA had
Webster wanted
them.
Webster wanted to do things according to Hoyle, mm-hmm. and this is the CIA. We don't actually always operate that way.
I haven't read it, but Milt Bearden certainly has a great eye on all things espionage. Eugene, thanks for the recommendation, The Main Enemy by Milt Bearden. John's calling from Princeton, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you tonight?
Great. Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope your guests aren't too upset with me. I'm currently reading a lot of e-books on my pocket PC.
Oh, my head book buyer at the bookstore may be crestfallen here, John. Are you really you're reading a lot of books on your pocket PC? No kidding?
Yeah, it's real easy to read on them. They're very clear. The typeset now is very nice.
How big is the pocket PC you're reading on? What are the dimensions of it?
Probably about 4 inches by 3 inches. It's a very small one.
No kidding. And you just press the button to turn the page?
Yep.
So, but are there new books on there? Do you have books from 2003 that are electronically available?
Well, yes, there are, and you can purchase them, but there's a lot of free books out there, too, and I'm reading Plato's Republic at the moment.
Ooh, that's the other 2003, the BC one. No, just kidding, not that old.
Yeah,
but
since one of your guests mentioned timeless classics, I thought that was in play.
So you're reading, how great, if Plato could only imagine, you're reading Plato's Republic on a pocket PC in 2003. You're truly futuristic, John. Thanks for your call. Helen's calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Well, this is coming full circle as the screener clued me in again, which Cradle to Cradle is a book I really want to bring up because I heard you talk about it on NPR, and it was so I bought it and read it, and I think it's such an important book.
This is William McDonough, Cradle to Cradle. Where he's describing how... What, as I recall, we could reconstruct our consumption and manufacturing so that everything gets used, so
exactly.
We don't have so much waste.
Exactly, and it's so exciting. I just feel that I want as many people to read as possible, so I've sort of been buying it, giving it to people.
You know, I know what you mean. Right now, when someone outlines a picture of the world that, with a change, would really work better, that's exciting.
Exactly.
What else do you have on your list, Helen?
I have Life of Pi, which... I bought it in Greece, read it in Greece, and on my way home saw people reading it and saw the ticket taker at Traverse at the Saratoga racetrack reading it.
Now, this is the boy in the lifeboat with the tiger. We may be cheating back to 2002 here. I'm not sure.
I think we
are. But hey, if you read it this year, we're happy to hear about it. I think it was a great one.
Also, quickly, Dennis Lehane's Mystic River. I think I insulted Dennis Lehane the other night telling him I didn't want to read it. And the reason I didn't want to read it is because I... But in Greece, didn't want to read a book about Boston in Greece and a murder one.
You insulted him. Were you hanging out with Dennis Lehane?
Well, I went to a discussion at the Coolidge Corner about screenwriting, whether it's sort of the new, the new writing for the sort of great American novel kind of thing.
Well, how authors love to have people come to their appearances and tell them they don't want to read their book.
What I meant to say was I didn't want to buy it, didn't want to read it, and then I did buy it, and I couldn't stop reading it.
So this is the book that the movie Mystic River came from?
Yeah, it's beautifully written, and it's hard as hell, but it's great.
That's great. Thanks for your list, Helen. Thanks very much. Galiel is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Galiel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for a great show.
Sure. Glad to do it.
My recommendations are in these interesting times we live in, which is the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times.
Yep, we feel it.
One of the ways that I found that I felt a little bit more empowered was to learn a little bit more about the world and about, in particular, nonviolent conflict resolution. So I have 3 books to recommend in that area.
Okay, our ears are open. What have you got, Galileo?
Well, the first one is kind of a historical perspective. It's called A Force More Powerful, Century of Nonviolent Conflict.
It's Jonathan Schell.
No, this is, he's the next one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is by Peter Ackerman and
Peter
Jack
Ackerman.
Duvall.
Yeah,
it's actually
that's
a companion
right.
book to a PBS series. And it covers actually historical... major historical nonviolent events during major conflicts, many of which people are familiar with, like the Solidarity Movement in Poland. But what fascinated me are some of the lesser-known stories, like French occupiers after World War I in Western Germany.
Okay.
And in that case, it was the occupiers employing nonviolent tactics to combat violent resistance.
This sounds like very timely inspiration to be
very
reading about nonviolence.
Then if you want a little bit of the kind of philosophical underpinning. Jonathan Schell's The Unconquerable World is just a brilliant book.
That's what I was thinking of. That's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely brilliant book. Mm. And very inspiring as well. And then finally, if you want to translate all this to action, there's Todd Gitlin's Letters to a Young Activist,
mm-hmm.
Modeled on Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. And there are a lot of great insights there. Todd Gitlin was the head of the Students for Democracy in Berkeley.
The SDS years
right.
ago, yeah.
And from the perspective of a few more gray hairs and a little bit of distance, he has interesting things to say. The real big insight for me was he makes a distinction between being motivated by rage and being motivated by anger. Anger being the positive force that can impel constructive protest, and rage being the thing that has us, turning around in circles and not getting much done.
Galileo, that's a fascinating distinction right now, and thanks for your whole list there. Thanks for calling in. Lev Grossman, you're sitting listening in New York to what our listeners are loving to read. What strikes you?
Well, it's definitely, it's great to hear people taking on these incredibly challenging books. You know, the cliché is that everyone's out there reading the Da Vinci Code and whatever's underneath the Da Vinci Code. But, you know, to hear somebody that passionate about Jonathan Schell, it's good to hear. I'm glad people are buying books like that.
May change your reviews in Time Magazine. Who knows?
It's
Charlotte, how about yourself? How do you see, I don't know, is it possible to read through the bestseller list and see other trends going on? What do you hear and what we're hearing from our listeners tonight?
Excuse me, that's a big question. The bestseller lists are, I think that there are a lot of different things going on, and often, just as a generalization, what's happening on the nonfiction side of the list, especially post September 11th, is really different than what's happening on the fiction side of the list.
I mean, some things didn't take off. The Enron books, for example, just didn't go anywhere, did they?
Well, that's true. Actually, I mean, getting back to sort of some of the bombs this year, business books have been tough since the economy took a turn for the worse at the end of 2000. And I think when the Enron scandal came along, a lot of publishers signed up books about it, trying to tap into people's questions about where American business was going wrong. And last year, there were a few quickie books, the sort of first to emerge about the Enron debacle, but none broke out to a wider audience. And then this year, the big budget books started to come. One of the biggest was Power Failure by Enron whistleblower Sharon Watkins, mm-hmm. Which she wrote with a journalist from Texas Monthly called Mimi Schwartz.
How did it do?
I'm afraid that one sank like a stone, partly because it was published just as the war broke out in Iraq, which was generally not a good time for book sales. People were just really stuck on their TVs.
I think at the same time, we heard so much about Enron when it first burst, and it's one thing to be upset when all the money's lost, and another to really dig into all that. I mean, do we really want to relive all that? We may be finished with, I mean, we shouldn't be finished with it as an issue to be fixed up, but we may be finished with spending hundreds of pages reading about it. Gosh, the hour has flown by so quickly, and we haven't even gotten to everything yet. You know, I want to say to our listeners that you can read the full favorite book lists of each of our panelists tonight at our website at onpointradio.org. And while you're there, you can go to the archives and listen to some of the authors who mentioned tonight who have joined us on Point. I want to thank each of you who's been with us tonight, Charlotte Abbott and Lev Grossman in New York. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Charlotte, it's great having you. And Carol Horn, right here in the studio, thanks for coming in. Great to hear your list again this year. And keep putting those books out there. We'll keep reading.
It's always fun to come.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.